This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 337 was recorded on August 18th, 2022. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Agricultural commodities expert Lee Gehring joins me to talk about the global food crisis in this week's feature interview. Lee says that emerging markets have discovered meat, and that creates an exponential demand for grains. We'll discuss long-term trends in grain demand, the present fertilizer shortage, and much more. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when Patrick's chart deck will be Tour of the Commodity Markets.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Eric, let's get to that S&P 500. Well, not too much to say there. I mean, it really feels like a little fake it to the upside, a little fake it to the downside, and we're pretty much not a stone's throw away from where we were last week. Looks like going into this option expiration, we're pinned into the 4,300 level. What do you think's coming up next here for the markets?
I have absolutely no idea what's next, Patrick, because this equity market doesn't make any sense to me. But hey, 200-day moving average is a significant technical resistance level. We just barely kissed it the other day. Now we're finding a little bit of resistance there. Makes perfect sense for the market to stop here. The question is whether we're going to break through that level and continue higher or not. Seems like a perfectly logical place for this rally to end. But frankly, I thought that back at the 100-day moving average, back around 4,100, and didn't stop there.
All right, well, let's move on to the dollar index, because we have a big update today, breaking to a fresh high of the month, anyway, for the month of August, as we get above this 107 level. And it's coming on the breakdown of the euro below the 101 level. What's your take on the dollar move here?
Well, Macro Voices listeners certainly should have seen this coming. We've been talking about it for a long time, but I think it continues. The dollar is going to continue to strengthen, despite the fact that long-term, I see some very serious risks for the dollar's hegemony over the global financial system. I think that will change before the decade is out. But for now, I think it's dollar stronger. We really ought to get Brent Johnson back on the show one of these days and get an update from him on his dollar milkshake theory.
Eric, let's move on to crude oil. How did the inventories come in, and what do you make of all the price action?
Well, EIA inventory came in with a headline crude oil drawdown of 7.1 million barrels. That's a really big drawdown to start with. But when you consider the 3.4 million barrels that was drawn out of the SPR, it means that the real effective total drawdown on crude oil stocks was 10.5 million barrels. But wait, it doesn't end there. Finished products also drawing down, at least gasoline did, 4.6 million barrels. Distillates was the build on the board at 766,000 barrels. Cushing, Oklahoma adding 192,000 barrels to inventory. U.S. production ticking back down 100,000 barrels to 12.1 million barrels after setting a cycle high last week at 12.2. Tape action, well, of course, necessarily in reaction to that inventory print, we saw a $3 spike up in oil prices. Wow. That lasted for all of about 20 minutes, and then it retraced fully back down to where we were before the inventory data even came out. And most importantly, it fell considerably short of the 200-day moving average on the contract chart, showing me that even with that inventory print, the price of crude oil just didn't want to move back above that key, what was previously a support level, now apparently turning into a resistance level. But that was yesterday's story. We ended up trading back down. Then a rally got started. And by the time we're recording today on Thursday, we're back above that 200-day moving average. Looks again almost like it did last week, where we got faked out and it looked like maybe the bottom was in. So we'll have to see what happens here, Patrick. I think the market is finally reached the point where the bulls and the bears are having the battle for where the bottom ends up finally being and when this market turns around in the other direction. But for now, the trend is still down.
All right. Well, let's quickly touch on gold. After gold poking above 1800 for a little bit, we're in the midst of some sort of a pullback. It's not completely out of character of after this dollar rally for gold to pause here. But what do you make of it?
Well, Patrick, our regular listeners know for the last couple of weeks, I've been feeling a little bit antsy about this gold market, just feeling like it feels like it might roll over. And sure enough, it's starting to roll over. I think as long as we can hold above 1758, where the 34-day moving average is, there's really not too much for reason for concern. It's probably, you know, just a little pullback. But frankly, it would make perfect sense if we just saw it roll over and move down to new lows below 1680. You know, it would just fit into a sequence of lower highs and lower lows. So did we just put in a new lower high in this ongoing sell-off, or are we just pausing in the beginning of the recovery? I think the jury is still out.
All right. Well, let's touch on the 10-year Treasury yield, which has been crawling a little bit higher in the last 2 weeks, but hasn't cleared 3%. We're at 2.88 at the time of recording here. What's your thinking on the yields?
Well, Patrick, we're still holding below that key resistance level of 3% on the Treasury yield. Let's continue to watch this. As far as having a view on where it's headed, I don't have one. I use the 10-year Treasury yield as a barometer to tell me how the inflation fight is going. Right now, what it's telling me is there's no big scores on either side.
Well, this week's featured interview guest is agricultural commodities expert Lee Gehring. Eric, why did we invite Lee on the show for as a first-time guest?
Patrick, this is a really important interview. We've been looking for a long time for an agricultural commodities guest who really understands the macro backstory and can explain what's going on in particularly agricultural commodities, but with food and food supply in general. And we've been trying to find the right guest for a while. It turned out that as I interviewed Adam Rosenzweig, energy expert, a few weeks ago, we had a conversation about this and realized that his partner, Lee Gehring, is the perfect person to do this interview. So I really encourage our listeners to listen carefully because Lee is going to say some very profound things. I think the implications of those things are even more profound. I'll have more to say about that in the post-game segment after the feature interview. But give this one a close listen, folks, because the consequences of things that Lee says about the long-term trend in agricultural commodity demand are really, really consequential in the long run.
Well, Eric's interview with Lee Gehring is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
If you invest to bring about a world powered by green energy, you should meet Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy that serves as a one-stop shop for green energy investors in Europe. Respect Energy brings together independent power producers, accredited and institutional investors holding assets in renewables or undertaking investments in new green energy production, such as wind and solar photovoltaic power plants. More than 600 institutional and accredited investors have already entrusted Respect Energy with the sale of their electricity production, portfolio management, O&M services, EPC, and project development. If you want to invest in green energy in Europe with the help of a trusted partner, contact Respect Energy today and ask for a tailor-made solution. For more information, visit respect.energy.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Lee Gehring, co-founder and co-chief investment officer for Gehring and Rosenzweig. Lee has some terrific downloads for you. First of all, there are two separate research reports, which we'll be referring to and which a lot of this interview is based on. Also, a slide deck, which pulls the most interesting slides out of those research reports that we're going to be referring to during this interview. You'll find the download links for all three of those things in your research roundup email. If you don't have have a research roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, click the red button that says looking for the downloads. And I recommend that you download the chart deck specifically because we'll be referring to the graphs and charts it contains during this interview. Lee, it's great to get you on the show. We had your partner, Adam Rosenzweig, on the show a few weeks ago talking about the energy crisis. I'm really excited to get the perspective on the global agriculture and fertilizer crisis so many people are talking about, but frankly, most of them think that this is a Ukraine-Russia-specific event. You've been analyzing and researching this for years, and I know your perspective is this is a much bigger picture that investors need to understand. It was exacerbated by Russia-Ukraine, but there's an underlying picture that's really important. Please tell us that big picture.
Okay, very good, Eric. Thank you very much for having me on. And I listened to your podcast with my partner, Adam, and where you covered a lot of the very interesting aspects of the energy market, and I thought that was excellent. Step back here for a minute. You know, one of the things that everyone believes in about the global agricultural crisis that we find ourselves into today is that it all began with Russia's invasion of the Ukraine. And I would like to say that the underlying fundamentals for this global agricultural crisis have been being put into place over the last several years. And it was only a matter of time before something occurred, some sort of potentially black swan event or some sort of underlying fundamental change in global agricultural supply that actually caused this crisis to occur. But whether it was the Ukrainian crisis brought about by the Russian invasion or not, something was about to trigger it off, and we're in a full-blown global agricultural crisis today.
Okay, Lee, let's dive into this. This is a story about demand globally for grains. Now, going back to the 1980s up to 2000 or so, what did the grain demand look like and why did it change around 2000 and what is it now?
Yes, Eric. This is critically important to what's brought about the crisis in global agricultural markets today. If you go back, the period from 1980 or the late 70s all the way up to 2000, global grain demand grew very consistently at about 1.3 to 1.5% per year, which was pretty much in line with per capita or pretty much in line with global population growth. However, starting in the late 1990s, a big fundamental shift began to happen in global grain demand. That trajectory, that line, basically pivoted up from about 1.3 to 1.5% all the way up to as high as 2.5% in the period from 2000 to 2020. And it was that big increase in global grain demand that we believe is one of the driving forces that has caused the global agricultural markets to eventually slip into crisis.
So you've got an underlying phenomenon, which is population growth over the world generally means that there's going to be exponential increase in demand for grains. But you just said it was, according to population growth, only up to about 2000. And then there was an inflection point where something changed. What changed? And let's refer to page one of the chart deck, because you've got an excellent graph that really explains this. What happened around 2000 that changed the demand for grain, where suddenly grain demand got much more exponential after that late 90s, early 2000s period?
Yeah, what's interesting is that if you study, dietary preferences and how dietary preferences change in emerging markets, almost all emerging markets in the post-World War II environment have gone through a very similar set of dietary preference changes. That is that when you're poor, basically you live in an economy that produces about $500 of per capita GDP, your diet is primarily starch-based. It's rice and bread, which is obviously grown from wheat or baked from wheat. And however, as your economy eventually grows and your country becomes richer, what begins to happen is that you begin to change your dietary preference. When all of a sudden, instead of $500 per capita GDP, you're up at $2,000 per capita GDP and then up $5,000 per capita GDP, you begin to actually want to consume a lot more animal protein. And one of the interesting things about growing animal protein is that it's much more grain intensive than just eating standard rice and wheat. the form of bread. So what happens is, as you consume more animal protein, the demands to produce more grain on a global basis increase substantially. And what's interesting is this chart is this just goes to show what the long-term relationship is between per capita GDPs and grain consumption. There is the bold line in this chart. This is an index that we constructed of the five, and there are only five of them. Actually, there are six, but one of them we don't have protein consumption data for. These are the only five countries from 1960 to today that have gone from basically having $500 per capita GDP that have grown to over $20,000 per capita GDP. In other words, they've gone from being poor to becoming rich. And what this index is nothing more that tracks and puts together a composite index of what the protein consumption did at various points of per capita GDP for each of these countries. And then what we did is we superimposed a lot of these Asian emerging market economies on where they stand in that protein consumption preference trajectory. So there's a lot of interesting stuff here to ponder. You can see, obviously, one of the reasons why this started in the late 1990s and 2000, the grain consumption began to pivot up hugely, was because of the entrance of China into this period of rapidly increasing animal protein consumption. You know, they've gone from basically $500 per capita GDP in the mid-1990s to basically $10,000 per capita GDP today. And what's happened is their animal protein consumption has basically increased fourfold. But what's so interesting about this chart is you can see there's a huge number of countries that have very large populations that are only now beginning to enter this period of rapid protein animal consumption. You know, countries like India, Indonesia, Pakistan, Bangladesh, each one of these countries now is only beginning to enter this period of rapidly changing their dietary preferences. And the populations of these countries are almost close to 2 billion people. So the thing is that the strong grain demand that we've seen starting back in the late 1990s, 2000, based upon our modeling, should continue as we go through the next 10 years.
Okay, so the underlying story here is a really good message, which is the poverty that used to exist all across the world has gotten a little better. Emerging markets got a little bit richer than they used to be. But the consequence of that is when they get richer, they want to eat meat too. And when they do, the cow that makes the meat ate a whole lot more grain than the peasant who was poor eating rice and bread would have consumed. And that means there's a much higher rate. So we've got several factors compounding on top of one another. You've got global population growth, just means demand for grains when you're eating rice and wheat yourself has to go up. Then you start to eat meat because the economy gets better, and that dramatically increases that rate. So no longer is it just a function of population growth, but it's an exponential function of population growth. And then on top of that, we've got the fact that maybe China has gotten to the point where it's sort of leveled off, but all of these other emerging nations are really just at the beginning of this story. That means that there's going to be a whole lot more increasing, exponentially increasing demand for grains in coming years. It sounds like, gosh, that's got to be the end of this story. But hang on, I read your report, Lee. This is just chapter one. There's also chapter two, which is about biofuels. What's the story there?
Yeah, one of the interesting things is that this is very unfortunate, but Western governments have encouraged this over the last 30 years, is that we've unfortunately have hooked global agricultural markets into global energy markets. And, you know, obviously, you know, when we think about higher energy prices, we think about, you know, the cost to make fertilizer or the cost to run a diesel tractor for our farmer. But one of the big, huge costs for energy is the idea as energy prices rise, that increases the demand for biofuels. And these are fuels, you know, we're very familiar with them, ethanol, which now in the United States, every gallon of gasoline that you buy today, 10% of that is ethanol. And they're talking about taking it to 15%, that we have basically, through the biofuels mechanism, we've basically hooked global energy markets into global grain markets. And this is the fact that we're in a global energy crisis, which you very, very well outlined with Adam in your previous podcast with him. The propensity to increase biofuel consumption is only going to continue. And I should point out, how big this has already become. For example, if you look at total global increases in oil production from 2010 to 2020, we basically increased global oil production by about 13 million barrels a day. About 8 to 9 million barrels of that came from the U.S. shales, which I know you and Adam talked about extensively in your podcast. But what's so interesting, the second largest item between 2010 and 2020 as far as oil growth is in the biofuels category. We basically added 2 million barrels per day of biofuels during that time period, which made it the second largest increase in oil source in the world. So, and if you read the papers done by the International Energy Agency, they project that we're going to have another 30% increase in biofuel consumption in the next 4 to 5 years. So the thing is that the energy crisis has now spilled over directly into the global agricultural markets. It is exacerbating the crisis that exists in that market today.
So global grain demand is growing at an exponential rate. That exponential rate increased substantially because emerging markets got richer. That also means that we have less acreage available for, as the global population grows, there's more cities and so forth. We don't have as much farmland acreage available to grow these grains in. And then on top of that, we've got policy that's leading to a rapidly and exponentially increasing demand for biofuels, which also depend on some of the same grains. You'd have to think, Lee, that surely that's enough to paint the picture for a perfect storm. But reading your research, there's another ingredient to all of this, which is we've had a really lucky spell of good weather for like 20 years now. What's the story there, and why would there be reason to think that the weather might not be as good for the next 20 years as it's been for the last 20 years in terms of how good the weather is for growing crops?
Yeah, I mean, you bring up a really good point there, Eric. One of the reasons why we were able to meet this huge ratcheting up of global grain demand from going like to 1.5% per year to 2.5% per year is that over the last 30 years, and certainly over the last 20 years, we, on a global basis, we've had an unprecedented string of great global growing seasons, specifically and not only in the Northern Hemisphere, but in the Southern Hemisphere as well. Now, that's highly unusual. Except for the drought years in North America and the U.S. in 2012, we haven't had a very disruptive event in global crop growing condition markets for a very, very long time. And that's what's enabled us to actually meet this big, huge ratcheting up of global grain demand. And we could talk, if we want, later, we could talk about the fertilizer input, why that's so important as well. That had a big input increase for the ability to ratchet up global grain supply during that time period. But one of the interesting things is we believe that we were on the verge of having weather patterns change significantly. And it's a little complicated, and it's a little esoteric, but I think it's very, very important. Like, what are the, obviously we've been in a global warming period pretty much over the last 50 years. And contrary to what you read in the press, where global warming will definitely hinder the production of global crops, our research tells us something completely different. That one of the best things that happened to global agriculture in the last 30 years is the world has gotten warmer. And that warming influences crop growing conditions in ways that many people don't think about. One of the most important things, and this is actually, I believe, on chart 2 that's in your deck, has been the increase in the Northern Hemisphere of the global growing season. Basically, in the U.S., for example, between the mid-1970s to today, we have increased the global growing season by about 12 days on average versus back then. And when you think about it, one of the biggest negative things that can happen that can damage crops in their growing cycle is having late late season frosts in the spring and early season frosts in the fall. So if you can push back those frost periods late in the spring and early in the fall, you by definition increase the quality of your growing season. And this has not only happened in the US, in Canada, in North America, this has happened across Europe and Russia as well. You know, the growing season in Russia and significant parts of Russia has increased, we believe, by almost a similar amount. And the numbers are really, really impressive. If you go back to 2000, Russia produced 19 million tons of coarse grains. That would be obviously primarily corn and wheat. And Ukraine produced 10 million tons. So about basically 30 million tons of grain. 2020, Russia produced 40 million tons of grain, coarse grain, and Ukraine produced 40 million tons of coarse grain for a total of 80 million tons of grain production. You know, those are incredible numbers. And one of the reasons why that took place is because Russia and the Ukraine, the former FSU, was able to increase significantly the length of its growing season. Now, we believe that this is all about to change, and we believe the change has already begun to happening, although it's being blamed for the wrong reasons, is that, you know, I'm a big believer that one of the reasons why we've had very, very good growing conditions over the last 30 to 40 years is because we've been in an unprecedented period of strong sunspot activity. The activity in the sun over the last 40 to 50 years has been in a very strong period, which is almost unprecedented in the history of people that study the solar activity. However, one of the interesting things starting back in the previous two sunspot cycles, which last about 11 years, is that we've seen significant decreases in sunspot activity. And we're in that third cycle, the 25th sunspot cycle, which again, it looks like it's going to be another down cycle for sunspot activity. Historically, if you go back, lowering sunspot activity for a lot of very interesting reasons winds up producing cooling periods. And cooling periods, if you study global agriculture, every global cooling period that we've been through has produced very, very disruptive weather events for agriculture. And it maybe, you know, everyone is blaming all the unusual weather events that we've had in global agricultural weather markets over the last several years on global warming. But maybe it's this transitional period that we're going from global warming to global cooling that's producing all this unbelievably difficult weather. So what I would think is that, you know, we've been blessed with 25 to 30 years of tremendously good global growing crop conditions. And I think we're entering in a period where global growing conditions are going to be challenged year after year by increasingly difficult a variety of events, whether they be floods, droughts, excessive heat, much earlier frosts in the fall and later frosts in the spring, things like that. So I think it's going to be very, very difficult to meet this big ratcheting up of global grain demand that we've seen over the last 20 years.
So we've got all of these factors coming together to really bring into question whether or not the world can grow enough grains to meet this exponentially growing demand for grains as we have less and less farmland available because of urbanization. But hang on a second, there's another dimension to this whole story, which is we've reached a point now where fertilizer is not just a convenience of farming. In other words, as much as some people might prefer organic fruits and vegetables, you know, if you can afford them, great. But we can't grow enough food for the entire planet now that we have 8 billion people on the planet as opposed to about 2 billion is what a lot of scientists think the natural support level was if you don't have modernized farming. You can't grow enough food for all those people without fertilizers. So fertilizers play a really important role. Tell us a little bit more about the role of fertilizer in this story from 2000 to 2020, the last 20 years where there's been this increase in demand. How has it played out and what are the challenges we're facing now?
Yeah, Eric, I can't overestimate the importance of fertilizer in the ability to world to increase its global grain production. Just some interesting facts just point that out. Like, for example, between 2000 and 2020, global grain supply grew a little over 40% during that time period. And what's so interesting is that, you know, you can debate what were the biggest inputs that caused that 40% surge in grain supply, whether it be crop genetics, good weather, or whatever. But one of the observations that you can't avoid is that grain production went up 40%, and the total application of fertilizers, that is nitrogen, phosphate, and potash, application of those three major fertilizers went up 40%. And even on a shorter term basis, between 2010 and 2020, global grain production went up basically about 10%, and fertilizer applications went up about 10%. So the thing is that obviously fertilizers have had a huge input into the ability of the global farmer to increase his crop yields. Now, what's so interesting about fertilizers is that just like, you know, we were talking about, you know, obviously the way the energy crisis is impact the agricultural markets through the biofuels transmission mechanism. One of the other ways that it influences global agricultural markets is that the making of fertilizer is incredibly energy intensive. And the thing is that we've already seen, for example, in the nitrogen complex, which is of course one of the great three, one of the three great fertilizer groups, is that we've seen because of high natural gas prices and the shortage of natural gas, which is a function of the global energy crisis that we've got going full bore in the world today, is that global nitrogen production is down. We estimate down about 5% on a year-over-year basis. And given the energy crisis that's still gripping Europe and the fact that natural gas prices in Europe are, you know, at $60 in MCF today, we believe that, you know, this constriction of fertile nitrogen supply will continue. And our analysis says that 5% reduction in nitrogen fertilizer on a year-over-year basis will ultimately impact and decrease crop yields by somewhere between 1.5 to 2% over time. So, you know, what's interesting is that, you know, the fact that we've got a potential fertilizer shortage developing on a global basis is another reason why we're going to have trouble growing food supply going forward from here.
Lee, you mentioned the natural gas connection. I just want to remind any listeners who didn't hear the previous interview with Adam Rosenzweig. Adam's contention is the really big story, as much as everybody's talking about oil, is natural gas. Americans don't think about it, but if you're in Europe, you know how big of a deal this is. Adam predicts it's going to be a really big deal for North America because he expects North American and European natural gas prices to converge. That means the cost of farming in the United States, because natural gas is an input cost of making so many different fertilizers, is going to increase dramatically. So the food inflation function coming from natural gas is tremendous. But there's another aspect to this, Lee, which is potassium, one of the other key fertilizers, comes from potash. Now, what everybody's talking about right now is that some of the biggest exporters of potash are Russia and Belarus. And of course, Russia and Belarus are allies. They're on the other side of this conflict from the West. That means they could withhold supply. Here's the interesting thing. Canada has almost as much proven reserves of potash as Russia and Belarus combined. Canada is by far the biggest country in terms of potash reserves. Now, to a normal thinking person who's not familiar with Canadian politics, you might assume that means that Canadian farmers are just swimming in fertilizer. They got more than anybody else. But the Canadian government is actually intentionally withholding it and trying to impose new restrictions on farmers, preventing them from using as much fertilizer as they want to, because they're trying to, as part of the whole climate movement, they're trying to reduce carbon emissions. I think there's some other stories around the world that you've written about. Tell us some other things that are going on, Lee, that fit into this story.
Yeah, and again, this highlights the importance of fertilizer application and how it positively impacts crop yields. One of the greatest experiments that's taken place in trying to restrict traditional commercial fertilizer application is what's taken place in Sri Lanka in the last couple years. The government of Sri Lanka, and it's not clear why they did this. Some said they wanted to save. They didn't have enough foreign currency to buy foreign produced fertilizer. But what they did is whether they were convinced by a think tank to actually go back to organic farming without the use of modern fertilizers. Whatever reason why they chose to do it, they did it. And the impact on crop yields was almost immediate and catastrophic. For example, obviously one of the major exports from Sri Lanka is tea. And it 1 year after they switched over from using traditional commercial fertilizers to using quote unquote organic fertilizers, that which was primarily animal dung, things like that, the tea yields or the yield from tea plants fell close to 25 to 30%. And since this was a huge source of foreign exchange income for the country, it set off a huge financial crisis in the country. So the thing is that you cannot underestimate the importance of fertilizer application and how it affects crop yields going forward. And as you mentioned, the potash market is interesting. 40% of the world's potash supply comes from Russia and Belarus. And most of those Russian potash supplies are getting out. However, the Belarus supplies, which go by rail through Lithuania, have been embargoed. So that's caused this huge tightness in global potash markets.
Now, let's quantify how this transmits to food prices, because, if you told me the cost of some minor ingredient, let's take uranium as an example. If the price of uranium doubles, well, you know what? The cost of uranium to a nuclear power plant is a tiny, tiny little line item. If the cost of the fuel doubles, it really doesn't affect the price of electricity very much. On the other hand, if you have, a key ingredient in some product, well, that's going to dramatically increase the end price of that product if that ingredient goes up in price. So let's assume, for sake of argument, that the cost of fertilizer were to double. Is that a 5% increase in the cost of food, or is that a 10%, or is that 100%? How does it translate?
Oh, that's a very interesting question, and I'd have to think about that, Eric. Obviously, one of the problems, fertilizer prices have run so strongly over the last years. I mean, basically, the entire nitrogen, phosphate, potash complex went from, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, $275 a ton to, there were potash prices actually broke $1,000 a ton selling into Brazil. Urea prices got as high as $900 and phosphate prices got as high as in the mid 800s. Now, if you're a farmer in an emerging market and you basically operate on a cash basis with no ability to draw on credit from banks, things like that, when you have a huge short-term surge in fertilizer prices like that, you can't afford to buy it. You just don't have the cash to buy it. So one of the things that we're seeing in many places of the world, a lot across Africa and some places in Asia, that farmers just don't even have the ability to buy fertilizer to apply because they just don't have the cash to buy an input that is now up 3 times in price from what it was a year and a half or 2 years ago. So how that translates into higher crop prices, it's going to, because obviously it's going to be another input reduction that winds up restricting supply in the face of this very, very strong demand. What's the actual price intensity of those cutbacks? I'm not so sure, but it's going to be significant.
There's another point I think it's really important that we make here, Lee, which is a lot of people in the green movement might say, oh, well, what we ought to do is get rid of these genetically modified seeds and get rid of fertilizers completely and go back to nature. Do it the way nature intended it, without any fertilizers, without any genetically modified anything. I think that's a terrific goal, but everything has a cost. And the cost of doing that would be we'd have to cull half of the global population because we've reached a point where it's not possible to grow enough food for everybody on the planet without using the technology of fertilizers and so forth. You've predicted that this could eventually lead to something you're calling food nationalism. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, in fact, this has already begun to happen. And I think we'll see increasing episodes of food nationalism as we go through this decade. And the last time we saw this phenomenon was all the way back in the 1970s, which of course was an inflationary period with their various points in the 1970s that had surging grain prices and had surging beef prices. But what food nationalism is that in order to bring down domestic prices or increase domestic supply, decrease domestic prices, what you do is you basically ban the exports of various food groups. Now, this cycle started with Indonesia, which is the world's largest palm oil exporter. And now that's interesting for a variety of reasons. Remember, one of the great inputs to biodiesel, and we don't have enough time to talk about biodiesel today, but obviously, you know, biodiesel is made from basically vegetable oils. And obviously biodiesel demand has been growing strongly because of ESG concerns, which has put an extra demand on global palm oil supplies. Now, you know, it's interesting. What happened there was that, you know, obviously a huge source of vegetable oil in the world comes from sunflower seeds. And it turns out that what is the world's largest sunflower seed producer in the world? It's the Ukraine. So when the Ukraine sunflower seed crop this year didn't happen because of the war, that created a huge shortage of global oils, cookie oils, vegetable oils. One thing that Indonesia did because of skyrocketing vegetable oil prices, palm oil prices, is that they banned the export of palm oil. So that's a classic example of what I would call food nationalism. And we've also seen India undertake it. Like, India had a big drought earlier this spring, damaged their wheat crop. And so what did India do? They put an export ban on all wheat exports. Now, India's become a major league wheat exporter the last several years. And they basically export close to, was estimated, almost 7 million tons of wheat, which is a significant amount. And that's all been banned. And that's all been done because of food nationalism in an attempt by the Indian government to increase wheat supply within the country and bring down the price. And once one country starts doing this, a lot of countries will begin to join on the food nationalism bandwagon, which happened back in the 1970s. And I think we're going to see this phenomenon happen over and over again as we progress through this decade.
Well, that really scares me, Lee, because it seems to me, and please tell me if I'm getting this wrong, it seems to me that this food nationalism you're describing, if I go back to what you've already said about the concentration of certain resources, most of the wheat in the world gets produced by a handful of countries. Fortunately, the United States is one of the biggest producers of grains, but there's a lot of countries around the world where they have to import all of their grains because they don't have the right kind of soil for growing it themselves. They've got to import all of that stuff from the exporting nations. So if the exporting nations stop exporting, entire countries could be unable to get essential types of food. And we're not talking about putting an embargo that says, okay, we're not going to export, you know, BMWs anymore. You can't have your sports cars and your luxury items from Germany because the German government's, you know, had some kind of conflict with your government. We're talking about the food you need to eat to survive is not going to be available because of changing policies of other countries. That's the stuff that resource wars come from. And frankly, we've already got a rapidly developing and I think mushrooming geopolitical situation globally where there's increased tension between the nuclear superpowers. You're telling me, if I'm reading this correctly, that we could have global food wars on top of energy wars coming before this decade is out. Please tell me I got that wrong.
Well, it's something to worry about. And again, we'll go back to how did we get into this problem in the first place? And it's basically, you know, one of the reasons why is that global grain demand has been very, very strong and has become much stronger in the last 20 years. And just to, you know, again, to harp on this, one of the big reasons is the number of people that are in that notch where they're changing their dietary preferences from going from starch to animal protein. You know, 30 years ago, there were somewhere between 500 to 700 million people that were in that period of their economic development. Today, with China in the midst of that period, they're not done with it yet, now being joined by countries like Vietnam, Philippines, Thailand, Indonesia, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, that you've got almost 4 billion people in that notch where they are beginning to change their dietary preferences. We've never been in that position before. Now you overlay that with the fact that you may have changing weather patterns, that you can't meet that strong demand. And then you throw on top of that, you know, things like food nationalism and the fact that you've basically hooked the global oil and natural gas markets into the grain markets through biofuels. And you have a period where I think you're going to have a very, very, you know, a rolling crisis and potential rolling crisis in global agriculture between now and the end of this decade. Now, whether this winds up with huge social unrest, it's a distinct possibility, and it depends on how bad things would get. And it's hard to say because we don't know whether we will have a disruptive weather, super disruptive weather events, things like that. But the situation is set up for potentially that to happen.
Well, this is kind of a somber point to change the subject, Lee, but this is an investing podcast. Where are the trades here? It seems to me like it's unlikely that energy and agriculture prices are going down from here. Do we invest in the actual commodities? Do we invest in the companies that produce them? Where are the best investments? Where are the plays for investors?
Well, I think the best, we talked a lot about fertilizers in the show today, and you know, I think that the fertilizer stocks, they've had big runs over the last year and a half or so, but they still represent tremendous investment. You take stocks like Mosaic, and I've followed Mosaic for almost 35 years, and I know its history very, very well. You know, basically Mosaic 20 years ago was a very sick company. And one of the reasons why it was a sick company is because their flagship potash mine, that is the Esterhazy complex up in Saskatchewan, had severe water flooding problems to the point where there was even talk back then that they may have to very well close the Esterhazy mine and take a massive write-off on their investment there. Now, since then, what they've done is they've developed a whole new mining shaft complex that's basically significantly up dip from the water flooding problems. So the water flooding problems will never be a problem again. And by doing so, that they will significantly lower their cash production cost to produce potash. First, they won't have to pump any water. And second, they have rebuilt those shafts very close to the working faces of the mine. So instead of having to spend 45 minutes to get to the mine face and then 45 minutes to get back to the shaft, you could basically walk out of the shaft and begin mining directly. So we're talking about being able to lower their cash costs significantly going forward from here on out. So what's so interesting is that in the last previous bull market peak in fertilizer prices, which basically took place in the first quarter of 2008, where the entire fertilizer complex peaked out at well over $1,000 a ton. Both nitrogen, phosphate, and potash all got as high as $1,200 a ton, that Mosaic traded basically, you know, 17 times peak earnings. Today, I would say that you're not anywhere near a peak in fertilizer prices. This fertilizer bull market has years left to run. And does anyone want to guess what Mosaic trades on today in earnings? It basically trades at 3 times fully tax reported earnings. The stock is radically undervalued. And it's the same way with Nutrien. Nutrien is the old, you know, the amalgamation of the old Potash Corp of Saskatchewan and Agrium. It is considered the quality name in the global agricultural space. You have significant fertilizer exposure to the agricultural farmer market through their retail agricultural outlet stores. You have the world's largest producer of potash, a big phosphate producer, big nitrogen producer as well. And that stock trades at 5 times this year's earnings. So the thing is that these stocks are ridiculously cheap. There's no way that they incorporate today's fertilizer prices, let alone what I think that fertilizers down the road will be significantly higher than where they are today. So the thing is, I think you've been given a tremendous buying opportunity in these fertilizer names.
Lee, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, I want to ask you about what you do at Gehring and Rosenzweig. And particularly, listeners, listen up, because the samples that you get from us in Macro Voices interviews are oftentimes from researchers who sell very expensive newsletters. You want to subscribe to the thing, you get the sample on Macro Voices, you get hooked, and then it's, you know, lots and lots of dollars in order to subscribe. Lee, the subscription to your letter costs zero. What's the story there?
Well, the story is that, you know, many people think that, and I know Adam mentioned this in his podcast with you, many people think that we are a research shop. You know, some of the research that we do on global commodity markets, I think is the best out there. And a lot of people will agree with us. And except we're not a research shop. We are a money manager shop. We manage money as a profession. And what we've done is what you see in our quarterly newsletters is all the research that we do that we incorporate into our investment process and how we construct our portfolios. So you as an outsider are getting a free look into what Gehring and Rosenzweig is thinking and how we're positioning our portfolios, what we like and what we don't like. And so it's a very nice opportunity for people to figure out what we're doing. But we're not a research shop. We do excellent research. I think we do some of the best research that's out there, but we are money managers. So if anyone's interested in having their money managed exclusively in global natural resources and commodities, we're the place to go. We have a tremendous long 30-year track record, which I would take up against any other person in the natural resource space.
And the website is www.gorosen.com. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this. After being completely sold out of advertising space for the last couple of years, we finally have capacity to add a new advertiser. Macro Voices has a PodTrac-certified global audience of over 170,000 listeners, and each weekly episode typically gets 60,000 to 80,000 downloads. We have more than 20,000 accredited investors who have registered with us as accredited, and we estimate the total accredited investor audience as at least 40,000 accredited listeners, which we believe to be the highest number of accredited investor listeners of any podcast on the internet. We strive to accept tasteful advertising from advertisers whose product is likely to appeal to our audience. So we're looking for another investment or financial services advertiser to fill the space I'm speaking in right now. Mail order Viagra salesmen need not apply. If your company wants to advertise on Macro Voices, please email sponsorship@macrovoices.com for more information. Now let's get right back to the show.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to get Lee on the show. You know, it really did make me think about how much focus I should be putting on those agricultural stocks and the opportunities there. I mean, they've already had a pretty good run over the last couple of years, but this recent pullback may be offering that second chance to get into a bigger secular trend that may be emerging. What did you take away from the interview?
Well, I think that a lot of the things that Lee said about the long-term change in the exponential demand growth pattern for grains is really important. The basic thesis that what's happened is emerging markets got richer and they discovered meat. Now that they can afford meat, that means that it takes a lot more grains to feed the cattle that are needed to make the meat. Makes perfect sense. But we've got a long-term balancing problem with just having too many people on the planet and not enough natural resources. And that change from 1.5% to 2.5% annual growth rate in commodities demand over the long term, there's a huge difference. As anybody in finance should know, the difference between a 4% return and a 6% return over 30 years is a hell of a big difference. And we're talking about much longer time frames than just 30 years here when we consider what's going to happen for global food demand. So I think in terms of a really big macro global picture, understanding that we're at the early stages of a global energy crisis and a global food crisis. And I'm going to further extend that based on my own observations and analysis to say that means we're at the early stages of a global power struggle between the nuclear superpowers over natural resources. I think perhaps the beginnings of the great natural resource wars that may be coming, the Ukraine and Taiwan conflicts may be just the flash in the pan that are the beginning of a huge conflict over natural resources. We see it in energy and we see it in foods. Now, in this particular interview, I'm completely out of my area of knowledge. I know that Lee's partner, Adam Rosenzweig, knows of which he speaks when it comes to crude oil. I make the assumption that Lee's information is all, you know, solid here. He knows what he's talking about. And if everything that he says is true, I think the implications and consequences of it are really significant in terms of the biggest trend of the next 100 years being an insufficiency of natural resources to support all the people on the planet, that leading to a major conflict between superpowers. So I think this is really, really huge stuff that has consequences that will last for decades. Anyway, let's move on to the present decade and a tour of the commodity markets. Listeners, you'll find the download link for Patrick's chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com. Look for the red button that says looking for the downloads. Patrick, tour of the commodity markets. What's going on here on page two with the S&P?
Well, I just wanted to start with a few charts, just updating the S&P 500 and the dollar, and then we can move on to the commodities. So what I wanted to simply highlight on the S&P 500, and you talked about the 200-day moving average. We're trading right at it. I don't have it on the chart here. What I wanted to highlight was that off of the June low, we are now 60 days and almost 19% or almost 700 S&P points off of the low. And what I thought was really interesting about the both the duration and magnitude of this rally is comparing it to the bear market in 2000 to 2003, which is where I have on page three. And what I wanted to simply highlight here was that, first of all, this is a weekly chart so that I can encompass the entire span of the bear market. But in 2001, and again in 2002, there was these significant bear market rallies. And once the short-term trading low was established, these bear market rallies lasted anywhere from 30 to 60 days. And in these cases, they were over 20% in length, in percentage gains off of their low levels. And I think we're coming to an incredibly important crossroad here on this advance, which is very similar to these types of bear market rallies. We're now going to find out in the coming month as we move into September whether or not this was in fact some sort of a bear market rally or whether or not there's something more bullish underway. And one way or another, this is a level right at that 200-day moving average where we're going to get some very important information over the coming weeks. It'll be really interesting to see how it develops.
Patrick, let's move on to the U.S. dollar index on page four. Looks like maybe we put in a short-term bottom there, and we're seeing at least a short-term trend reversal. What's happening here?
Yeah, like I really just wanted to highlight a couple of things. First of all, in technical analysis, it is common for what were previous highs to act as support and pullbacks, for retracements to be, you know, 50% of the prior rises. This entire pullback over throughout July into this early part of August fit the characteristics of a very natural consolidation or retracement of a prior bull advance. With us seeing today's breakout candles, there's no reason to believe that the prevailing bull trend and the pattern of higher highs and higher lows and all dips being bought has shifted or changed. I don't have the euro chart up here, but the fact that the euro is breaking down below 101, heading right back to parity, is just once again going to come to a really important test. I mean, if the euro doesn't hold parity, I doubt it stops at 99 cents. And so there's really the backdrop of a make it or break it moment, even as the US dollar yen is heading toward 136. We're going to really see whether or not the US dollar gains some traction. But the bigger thought I have on that, Eric, is typically U.S. dollar strength is associated with a risk-off impulse. And it's interesting that the dollar is attempting to break out at a time where the S&P 500 is reaching an important crossroad and many commodities are weak and other things like that. It'll be really interesting to see whether a dollar breakout engages here and whether that spills into the inner markets and starts to drive a risk-off impulse in the, going into Labor Day. With that said, Eric, let's move on to crude oil. And this chart right here, when I snapped it, oh, crude oil was at $90. But we, as we speak here on that September contract, we're already at $91.37. Just it's been a rather quick little rally that's been happening over the last couple hours. To me, this is actually a really important crossroad. As we broke to a lower low just a few trading sessions ago, typically that opens a floodgate. As a lower low is made, it usually creates a feedback mechanism of technicians and chasing trend, stop losses being hit, margin calls being made, and usually it leads to some downdraft. But oil broke temporarily to a lower low, and very quickly is snapping back. Now, the pattern of lower highs and lower lows is very distinct, and by no means is this chart bullish yet. But one of the very key things that I'm going to be watching going into next week is whether we can wipe out the entire last sell-off, which is get crude oil makes it all the way back to 95 plus. If we see that it can crack 95, pullbacks are being bought on dip, and the whole chart is turning up, maybe this 2-3 month sell-off in crude oil may be coming to an end. What's your take on it?
Well, I'm certainly watching closely, Patrick. The fact remains that right now what we have is a series of lower highs and lower lows. If we can turn that around, as you say, and get above last week's high at 95 and turn this into a sequence of higher highs and higher lows, that's a whole other story. But that hasn't happened yet. And for now, what has surprised me was, you know, even on that really, really big inventory draw yesterday, it caused an algorithmic panic spike of buying, and it was immediately sold. So there were people who were still skeptical enough of this market that, you know, even trying to recover to the 200-day moving average, they were selling hard into that. So there's at least some of the market that thinks this is not over yet. And at some point, I'm sure the bulls are going to win because we don't have enough energy left to return the economy to normal. But we probably need to get through the recession before that's going to be a factor.
Eric, let's move on to gold. I just wanted to highlight, I agree in many ways with what you were saying in the market wrap at the beginning. I mean, I remain bigger picture bullish gold, but there's no denying lower highs, lower lows in a downtrend with this current rally looking no different than the bear market rally we saw in the S&P 500 and just rolls over. And so really, there is no evidence that a bottom is in and that it's all bull from here. But if it was going to turn bullish, Eric, one of the things that would be seen here is that this current sell-off that rolled over shouldn't make lower lows, right? And so as we get to 1750 or even a very deep retest of 1700, we should see the bulls defend the line pretty well and quickly rally it back above 1800. If we started seeing those kind of characteristics into September, then maybe there could be signs of a reversal and bottoming formation, but it's very premature to make any of those conclusions. It'll be all about the way the sell-off looks, and that's what I'll be watching from here.
Well, I agree. It's definitely premature to decide whether this is just a little pullback or if it's a trend reversal and we're headed to lower lows. But I'm going to give it a 50-50 either way. I don't think there's any reason to be too super bullish here. Let's move on to natural gas futures on page 7.
Now, this is where there's a market that is marching to the beat of its own drum. Natural gas continues to make higher highs and higher lows, but really now has worked its way right back to those major highs that it put in through the summer. And where as we approach this level, we're about to get that really important tell as to whether or not another bull run may emerge here. If this just cracks those highs on a closing basis, there's every chance that we might see $11 or $12 on the upside of nat gas. Now, have we broken to new highs yet? No. But it's certainly the thing to watch here on nat gas.
I agree, Patrick, and for anyone who missed it, you definitely want to hear Adam Rosenzweig's interview on NatGas a few weeks ago, as he has a very bullish view on where it's headed from here. Let's move on to copper futures on page 8.
So what's interesting is obviously everyone follows copper as Dr. Copper, which is a sign of economic health. And clearly with an economic recession and a slowing economy, that copper demand going down is not abnormal. So we had a very violent drop through June into July. And since here, it's been retracing. I think it mirrors what we're seeing in gold in many ways. Now, obviously, it's a different type of metal, but it was very oversold. It's bounced, but there's really just no evidence that this is anything more than a bear market rally, very similar to what we saw on that other chart. And it would not be a shocker for us to see copper go and retest its lows, establish double bottoms, create basing formations. It's just really hard to make a case that this is going to start bulling in this window of time. With that said, I mean, I still am a commodity bull in the bigger context. It's just these charts just it may be a little bit early in the month of August looking for the next bull markets to start. Though, Eric, when I want to move on and actually to page 9, look at lumber. And now this is where there's been some really ugly bear market price action. And while lumber had two amazing rips in 2021 and 22 that saw prices get up to $1,300 to $1,700 on the upside, we've really seen a very tough 6 month go for lumber as we've gone from 1,300 and temporarily traded below 500. What we have is a very interesting little reversal that happened the other week, and it'll be really interesting to see if this starts to show signs that we've hit some sort of a short-term low after such a prolonged sell-off. It'll be really interesting to see whether there's more selling to come or whether this is all really now been realized.
Moving on to wheat futures on page 10, looks like we've retraced most of that premium that came in after the Ukraine war started.
Yeah, this is what made the interview with Lee so interesting, and that's why I felt that we had to put it in. Certainly, there's an argument to be made that the grains are going to be bullish in the decade to come, but this recent pullback in the last couple of months has done some very serious technical damage to any bull trend. With this deep of a pullback underway, there's definitely no sign of a bottom just yet. Now, can we get down to below 700? Or even lower? Or when are we going to start seeing this trend shift? That's one of the bigger questions. I really do agree with Lee in many ways and think that there's an opportunity to trade this bullishly, but this chart is pretty ugly right now. What I though wanted to just touch on, Eric, was on page 11, I put on the Agricultural Producers Fund, which is the symbol VEGI. And what's interesting is that while many of the grains have been selling off pretty hard and are not far off of their multi-month lows, this bear market rally in equities certainly has spurred quite a reaction in many of those ag names, including the two that Lee mentioned, which was Mosaic and Nutrien. Both of them have had meaningful rallies, which is reflected in this ETF. And really what will be interesting to see is will they all head right back down? Will we see some sort of retesting? And where is the real buying opportunity in the space? Yeah, I do agree in many ways that this is a great space to be in. But after this thing has gone from $37 to $44 in a month, it's certainly not my favorite spot from an asymmetry perspective to start buying up here. It'll be interesting to see the way it behaves during pullbacks.
Listeners, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading, Patrick's trading service. Information's on page 12 and 13 of the slide deck or at bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's research roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to Lee's slide deck, as well as the chart book we just discussed here in the post game, as well as a number of links to articles that we found really interesting. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow me on Twitter at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.